Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do you think? Are you one of those who figures the economy's strong enough to stand up to a failing housing market? Or do you think it's going down the drain? Or maybe you're more like this guy and you just don't know.
The uncertainties around the outlook have increased somewhat in recent weeks.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Marketplace is also supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at vanguard.com.
From the studios of KUNC in Greeley, Colorado, I'm Kai Rizdahl, just north of Denver, in case you're curious. It's Wednesday today, March 28th. Glad to have you with us. Have you ever noticed nothing economic seems real until the chairman of the Federal Reserve had a chance to weigh in on it? Ben Bernanke was on Capitol Hill today. He talked about this and that. But what everybody wanted to know was what he thinks of real estate and whether the subprime market will torpedo the rest of the economy. In a nutshell, maybe, maybe not.
We continue to expect the economy to grow at a moderate pace, so we expect continued growth. There are risks to the outlook in both directions, as I indicated, so we'll have to watch to see, you know, how big, if those risks materialize, and if so, how serious they are.
But Hugh Johnson of Johnson Illington Advisors pointed something out to us. He said Fed chairmen really don't use words like uncertainty and risk willy-nilly.
In other words, he's saying we're still inflation fighters, but in response to some of the weakness in the economy, maybe at some point we'll reduce short-term interest rates.
The words were barely out of Mr. Bernanke's mouth this morning when the market started dropping. Suffice it to say, it'll be the sad music when we get there. And hey, only 30 trading days left until the next Fed meeting. Consumer electronics is a tough business these days. Price wars over laptops and flat-screen televisions have cut into profits. The once high-flying Circuit City announced a major restructuring plan today. The country's number two electronics retailer says it plans to replace more than 3,000 workers with people who will work for less. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more now from New York.
It's a funny time in the consumer electronics business. Demand for high-definition TVs is soaring, but so many producers are making them, including discount Asian manufacturers, and so many different companies are selling them, from Costco to Best Buy, that retailers are struggling to make a profit. Consultant Nick McCoy with TNS Retail Forward says Circuit City is no exception.
Sales have been through the roof, and prices have dropped like a stone.
Circuit City's solution is to cut costs. So in meetings held around the country today, 3,400 people learned they no longer had jobs. Officials say those workers earned above-market salaries. The company says lower-paid staff will replace them. Analyst Joe Feldman follows Circuit City for Telsey Advisory Group. He says the strategy could backfire.
Presumably the most expensive workers in the store were probably the more qualified workers that are also the more knowledgeable ones. So that could degrade service a little bit.
Not to mention morale among those left behind. Feldman says morale and sales fell a few years back when Circuit City switched from higher commission-based pay to hourly wages. The company announced other cost savings today. It plans to outsource some information technology jobs to IBM and may sell its stores in Canada. Officials say those who lost jobs will be paid severance and after 10 weeks are welcome to reapply. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Negotiators are scrambling to meet an end-of-the-week deadline to hammer out a huge free trade deal with South Korea. The two countries already trade $75 billion worth of goods a year. Think Samsung and Hyundai's being sold on this end. If an agreement can be reached, it would be the biggest trade pact for the U.S. since NAFTA back in 1993. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports there are plenty of critics on both sides of the Pacific.
In South Korea, free trade opponents have held street protests and hunger strikes. The agriculture industry there fears a flood of cheap American farm products. At the same time, South Koreans are eager to keep the U.S. as the biggest customer of their cars and electronic goods. Meanwhile, American businesses see Korea as a huge potential market. Troy Stangerone at the Korea Economic Institute says U.S. car makers are savoring the prospect of more balanced trade between the two countries.
The U.S. has had a long history of difficulties in the Korean market. Right now, Korea sells about 700,000 cars in the U.S., and the U.S. sells about 4,000 in Korea.
The American beef industry is following the South Korean trade negotiations closely. South Korea had been the industry's third largest export market before mad cow disease hit here in 2003. The chief economist for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Greg Dowd, says 4 years later, just about every other country has resumed importing U.S. beef.
Korea is one of the final holdouts in the entire world on our beef, and they're an enormous market for us. And we're putting some pressure on right now to say that it's high time to deliver on this.
Trade negotiators in Seoul are working to meet an end-of-the-week deadline imposed by the looming expiration of President Bush's fast-track trade negotiating authority. Congressional Democrats have proposed extending fast-track if the White House agrees to labor and environmental standards for future trade deals. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There was news this morning Burger King's making some menu changes. The burger chain said it's going to start getting its eggs from free-range hens and pork from free-range pigs. Trouble is, there isn't really enough free-range stuff to go around. Burger King says it'll start small and ramp up. So we asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to look into whether it can really make a difference.
Every year, the Burger King stores in North America go through around 35 million pounds of pork and more than 40 million pounds of eggs. The company says it's going to try to get those eggs from free-range chickens and pork from pigs that aren't kept in cages. Marcia Mogolansky is an analyst at research from Mintel International. She says the company's responding to popular requests.
There is a growing sensibility among the general population that we should be trying to eat in a more ethical fashion.
Like other fast food restaurants, Burger King has also been hammered by animal rights activists for ignoring animal welfare. But Mogolansky warns the definition of free range is still pretty loose, so it's hard to know exactly what Burger King's planning to do. In any case, the company says it can't get nearly enough free range products to meet its needs. So for now, only about 2% of the eggs and 10% of the pork products will be free range. The hamburger chain says it'll use more as the stuff becomes available. Sherry Day Scott edits QSR Magazine, a trade publication for the food industry. She says demand from the fast food business could change that.
If McDonald's and Burger King tomorrow said, in 10 years, we're only going to be serving organic beef, you would see not only just the small mom-and-pop farms with the Tysons that everyone's changed over to that.
Still, she says, most Americans don't care where their food comes from. They just want to know they won't get salmonella or worse from that $1.50 burger special. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Bernanke speaks. Investors, as always, listen. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If analysts are to be believed, we're a step closer to the first bankruptcy to come out of the subprime mortgage meltdown. New Century Financial cut its ties with the mortgage giant Freddie Mac today. That takes it out of a huge chunk of the market and could be a prelude to Chapter 11. Mortgages are getting all the bad press, but other kinds of subprime borrowing are just as common. In everything from credit cards to fast cash, more Americans are paying more for their loans, as Marketplace's Steve Tripoli reports.
Under pressure.
The applause was subdued and even stunned during the closing credits at last week's Boston premiere of a new documentary. Maxed Out takes a bleak look at the personal debt explosion that's leaving many Americans under pressure. After the screening, viewers stopped to discuss what they've seen in their lives. Jill Richard of nearby Medford was first.
I went to get a mortgage originally from my house, and they said it was going to be a certain percentage, and then it seemed like by the time the mortgage came out, it was like 2% more.
A therapist who counsels college students says many struggle with debts they incurred without their parents' sign-off. She asked not to be named.
I mean, they're depressed and they're working many, many hours in addition to going to school full time.
Kathleen Kohlauer of Boston tells of a friend who got into trouble charging her antidepressant drugs.
She came to me one day and said, people are calling me day and night about the money that I've spent on paying for these medications.
It's easier than ever to borrow these days, but not nearly as easy to get low-cost credit. Longtime legal services lawyer Diane Thompson serves the counties around East St. Louis, Illinois. Urban or rural, Thompson says all kinds of subprime lending flourish in those communities.
One very prevalent form are subprime credit cards. Another very common kind is subprime car financing. Title loans, people borrowing money on their car titles. A lot of payday lending.
The common denominator is high fees and interest rates, often between 100 and 600% a year. Thompson says a single small loan can trigger a cycle that has people paying many times the amount borrowed. Could East St. Louis be some kind of rare subprime hotbed? Not by a long shot, says Kathleen Keast at the Center for Responsible Lending.
Well, you can find it everywhere.
Her center tracks subprime lending nationwide, and its researchers often testify before Congress. Keast says mortgage and non-mortgage subprime lending has mushroomed. She says there's been a radical change in American lending practices in a single generation.
20 years ago, if anyone said that, people would be arguing that 360% small loans were defensible. Or 10 years ago, if you said that there'd be an entire billion-dollar industry, which is what the payday loan industry is, I think people would think you were nuts.
The explosion in payday lenders who advance loans against the borrower's next paycheck shows just how quickly the subprime sector has grown. A University of California study says these lenders have added 22,000 U.S. stores since 1990. By comparison, Starbucks has opened just 8,500 outlets since then. So why has so much lending, credit cards, car loans, fast cash, gone subprime? Alan White researches the industry's underpinnings at Community Legal Services in Philadelphia.
What's happened because of deregulation and the free flow of lending capital through the securities markets is that there's all this capital chasing American consumers. And the result of that has been riskier, higher-priced credit chasing out more prudent credit.
White says high-priced credit displaces regular lending for several reasons. First, it's lucrative, and it's fed by worldwide investor demand for lenders' securities. That demand floods markets with cash to lend. With loads of new cash, lenders loosen standards and aggressively market credit, like the $6 billion pre-approved credit card solicitations mailed out in 2005. Looser lending standards add risk. Alan White says the subprime push then starts feeding on itself, stoking ever higher rates on a given individual's loan.
And it becomes subprime, not because the individual has changed, but because the amount they're borrowing has pushed their debt ratios to the point they can't qualify for conventional credit.
If the high-priced loan becomes a problem, or if payments are late, which happens more these days, the borrower's credit rating suffers. That makes their next loan more likely to be subprime, and on it goes. In an upcoming story, we'll hear from those who say subprime lending has helped lots of people, and we'll examine the impact on those it hurts. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
If this subprime stuff is personal for you or for your neighbors, tell us about it at marketplace.org. And now, let's do the numbers. Ah, yes, the wah-wah trombones. If the markets could talk, I bet you they'd say something like, bad, bad Ben. I'm talking about those none-too-optimistic remarks from the Fed chief that we mentioned earlier. The Dow Industrial sank 96 points, almost 0.8% to finish the day at 12,300. The Nasdaq slumped 20 points, more than 0.8, to end at 2417. The S&P 500 went along for the ride, down 11 points, 0.8% to close at 1417. Abercrombie & Fitch was riding high. The S&P 500 added the hipster retailer to its index. Shares sauntered up about a third of 1%. Even the world's biggest retailer can't make it everywhere. Reports said today Walmart Stores has postponed plans to open a store in New York City. Shares down almost 1.8%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 1-877-T-ROWE-PRICE. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the fourth quarter gross domestic product report. The Senate Finance Committee convenes a hearing on clean energy. And the New Zealand actress who portrayed Xena, Warrior Princess, celebrates her birthday. Lucille Frances Ryan, better known as Lucy Lawless, will be 39. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Even though the economy's slowing, and no less an economist than the chairman of the Federal Reserve says even he doesn't know where it's going to end up, there is plenty of money sloshing around out there, on Wall Street especially. Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein said yesterday the world's biggest investment bank plans to raise about $20 billion for a new private equity fund. Maybe a little more, maybe a little less. The announcement comes on the heels of the Blackstone IPO. That private equity group has about $18 billion to play with, and it's going to be getting another $4 billion from investors. Some analysts are criticizing the recent boom in private equity transactions as unsustainable. Economist and commentator Glenn Hubbard wonders about that.
The Blackstone IPO has generated substantial controversy and not a little jealousy over what the principals at Blackstone stand to earn, as well as a few misunderstandings about private equity. In private equity's defense, insiders don't earn too darn much money. They're getting it fairly, from fees earned for management responsibilities and for performance. But that performance only pays when these people deliver big increases in shareholder value. And the current high returns are in large part due to the skill of those private equity managers, the people who re-engineer operations and suggest new strategies for growth. It's also true, of course, that today's low borrowing costs have put strong winds in the sails of big private transactions. Those interest rates have more to do with saving decisions in China and the Middle East than with financial machinations at home. We won't necessarily see very high returns in private equity as far as the eye can see. For one thing, a rising risk premium, higher interest rates in debt markets, will make highly leveraged transactions more costly and less attractive. And traditionally, very successful private equity deals have focused on finding lesser-known, high-value opportunities or promising turnarounds. Today's size of funds puts us in somewhat uncharted, but not necessarily unpromising waters. Giant funds will have to pursue acquisitions of much greater size and prominence, and the competition among private equity firms is likely to reduce returns. But private equity remains important. The best private equity firms will still improve management and returns. And private equity will remain a source of capital patiently awaiting results. It also remains a key investment for our own portfolios through our pensions and other investments. Stay tuned.
Glenn Hubbard used to run the Council of Economic Advisors for President Bush. He is now the dean of Columbia University's Graduate School of Business. If you think he got it right, or if you think he got it wrong, or if you just want to talk, drop us a line. Our homepage is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Think about this the next time you pick up a newspaper. It's almost as much a marketing tool as it is a report on the events of the day. Sure, relative news value helps decide what story to put where, but you're not going to buy it if it looks boring, right? Despite editors' best efforts to sell their products, newspapers have been having a heck of a time lately. Staff cuts and falling circulation. The New York Times just called February the cruelest month so far for advertising revenue. The Poynter Institute released a study today all about how people read papers, which explains why many papers are getting a makeover. Lynn Milner reports.
In January, the Wall Street Journal launched a new design. It's the paper's second in 5 years. The New York Times plans one for 2008. The LA Times is embarking on one. Everybody's doing it, or already has. But a lot of critics would have us believe that the newspaper is dying. Could all these redesigns be a sign that it's alive and kicking?
Well, I think it's certainly a sign that there's nothing to be complacent about in the business now.
That's Rick Edmonds. He tracks the industry for the Poynter Institute. He says that 94% of a newspaper's revenue still comes from print. So print needs to look alive, and its content needs to draw people in immediately. In fact, content trumps cosmetics, says Mario Garcia. He oversaw the redesign of the Wall Street Journal.
Otherwise, it's like dressing a cadaver. I mean, if you can make a newspaper look very pretty, many of them have died looking wonderful. And many ugly newspapers are still alive. In a few hours, this is lining up a birdcage or you wrap fish with it, you know. So this is not a product to beautify.
You rethink the stories you put on page one. You offer articles that are surprising. You provide analysis, not just breaking news. Then you try to hold the eye, which is more important than ever.
10 years ago, when a person opened the front page of a newspaper, they took 25 seconds to sort of do what I call reconnaissance, to go around the page and say, what will I read? Right now, it's about 10 seconds.
Lots of newspapers, like the Journal, have become physically smaller. That saves money on newsprint. Papers have also changed placement of some regular features, like the weather, to open up lucrative ad space. Alan Jacobson of Brass Tacks Design in Norfolk, Virginia, has been redesigning papers for 30 years.
Most newspapers use two metrics to measure success, readership and revenue. When you look at those two metrics, it's the revenue that's more important because we're in business to make money.
Ad revenue is the holy grail. But readership is what motivates advertisers to choose a particular venue. So many newspapers came to the Poynter Institute for advice on what format to use that the Institute decided to study what formats readers like best. Poynter studied nearly 600 people. Project Director Sarah Quinn describes the equipment used.
Kind of the conventional wisdom was that people tended to scan when they were reading online, but maybe not read too much of the text itself. But we found that in print, they were reading a little bit less than readers were online.
Once online readers choose a story, they read about 3/4 of it. In a broadsheet, people read nearly 2/3 of a story, and only a little more than half in a tabloid. Poynter also looked at story forms, for instance, long narrative versus mainly graphics with catchy bullets, something readers liked best. Still, Poynter didn't look at content itself, which Alan Jacobson says is key.
For instance, if you had a 2,000-inch story about Princess Diana, any Anglophile will read every column inch of that story, regardless of the format. I worked with an editor once who told me, Alan, they will read it if we print it on a paper bag, if they care about it.
If Jacobson is right, but news holes keep shrinking, is there still hope for print? In Florida, I'm Lynn Milner for Marketplace.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce estimates counterfeiting and piracy cost legitimate manufacturers $750 billion a year worldwide. Everything from fake purses to pirated music and video discs. So there's a lot of interest in getting black market goods off the market. In Morocco, 5 video pirates have been sentenced to prison after police seized 500,000 counterfeit film and music CDs. That's what you might call fighting piracy the old-fashioned way. John Lawrenson reports from Casablanca, some of Morocco's most ripped-off artists are finding new ways to beat the bad guys.
The comic Saïd Nassiri on Moroccan TV. Nassiri is Morocco's most successful actor, most successful filmmaker, and therefore one of this country's most robbed citizens. He's so fired up against DVD pirates, he accompanies the police when they go on raids. It makes them feel more guilty when they see my face, he says. Another stand-up comedian, Hassan El Fadd, has taken matters into his own hands.
I have to pay a team of anti-piracy guards to make sure no one's filming when I do my one-man show. I can't do open-air venues, that'd make it too easy for the pirates. And we can't release the film we've made of my latest show because as soon as it's out, it'll be copied, everyone will see it, and no one will come to see the show. Once you've heard a joke once, you're not going to pay to hear it again.
Down at Deir Khalef, a big open-air market on the outskirts of Casablanca, a dollar will buy you the new comedy Borat, although it isn't even out in cinemas here yet. What you won't find here or anywhere else in Casablanca are legal DVDs, which would be 10, even 20 times more expensive.
It's bad for those who've worked hard to make the film, but it's good for people who don't have much money.
Do you buy them yourself?
What? Yeah, of course.
Do you feel guilty?
A little.
To tell you the truth, I buy pirated DVDs. The Last Samurai, for example. I bought it while it was still playing at the Rialto. I paid 5 dirhams, 50 US cents. That's not cheaper than going to cinema. It's much, much cheaper.
A cinema audience of 5 watches a new Moroccan blockbuster. According to the Moroccan Film Board, dozens of cinemas like this will close this year. And, says its director general, Nourdine Sale, piracy is partly to blame.
Police operations against video piracy reassure cinema owners as well as film producers that it's worth staying in business. We're going to see many more raids in the future. The pirates have to be afraid.
But if the pirates who print the CDs are afraid, it's not showing at the stalls at Deir Khalef, where the tables are still stacked high. Ashkine, one of a bunch of Moroccan rap groups whose reputation was built on pirated songs and videos exchanged on the internet. This year, they signed a record deal and brought out a CD, a real one. But what's the difference? It just gives the pirates something better to copy. Unless these raids turn into a long-term clampdown, Ashkine can sell like Puff Daddy. They still won't get a penny. In Casablanca, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, Marketplace is brought to you today by the letter M. 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 Markets, mergers, monopolies, and Macy's. The department store's parent company, Federated, announced today it's going to rename itself Macy's. As part of the switchover, the company plans to start trading its shares on the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker symbol M. There has been a persistent rumor that the big board was reserving M for Microsoft, just in case the software giant ever wanted to switch its listing from the NASDAQ. Some of the other single-letter tickers that are still available on the NYSE include G, possibly for Google, and I, for Intel. Both of those companies currently do trade on the NASDAQ. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. We've got some numbers of the day to go along with the letter M. The Dow fell 96 points, about 0.8%. The NASDAQ lost 20 points, about 0.8% there as well. The S&P 500 dropped 11 points, exactly, yes, 0.8%. Our engineers include Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, and Joel Stein. Next time on the program, the imponderables of living in New Orleans.
For whatever reason, there just aren't many grocery stores in the city. Oh, I guess I could drive out to the suburbs, but then there's traffic, which I also don't understand. If New Orleans lost half its residents, why is there stop and go on the interstate?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.